Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the worsening situation in Venezuela following the electoral coup by the unpopular Maduro government, which has defied the will of the majority in a power grab that has shut down the opposition, arrested its leaders, and exposed divisions within the ranks of the military. Alejandro Velasco, a historian of modern Latin America at New York University and the author of Barrio Rising, Urban Popular Politics and the Making of Modern Venezuela, joins us to discuss whether in a country racked by crime and awash with guns, the opposition will turn to armed resistance. We will also assess the likelihood of a split within the military between junior officers who want to reestablish constitutional order and the top leadership whose loyalty to the government has been ensured by Maduro, who has lavished generals with economic spoils and allowed their active participation in the lucrative drug trade. Then we'll look into the unusual unity on the UN Security Council in their unanimous condemnation of North Korea as the world body ramped up sanctions on the isolated country whose exports of coal, seafood, iron ore, lead, and cheap labor are now blocked. Kyung-Moon Hwang, a professor of history at the University of Southern California and author of Rationalizing Korea, The Rise of the Modern State, joins us to discuss the possibility of imaginative diplomacy ending the stalemate if the U.S. were to offer the North a peace treaty and refuse to be the enemy anymore, thus removing the glue that holds the Kim regime in power. Then finally, we will investigate the real reasons behind the opioid crisis in America and why the epidemic is not being dealt with effectively. Stephen Schwartz, the editor of the daily web publication, theschwartzreport.net, joins us to discuss his article in the journal Explore, America's Deadly Opioid Epidemic, from which everyone but the users profits. And joining us now is Alejandro Velasco, who is a historian of modern Latin America at New York University, where he focuses on social movements, urban culture, and democratization. He's the author of Barrio Rising, Urban Popular Politics, and the Making of Modern Venezuela. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alejandro Velasco.
Thank you so much.
And at this point, it looks like the unmaking of Venezuela is going on. How dire do you consider the situation, Alejandro?
I mean, it's dire. It's certainly the worst that it's been over the last 20 years, perhaps even longer. To the shortages of food and of medicine that we hear about and have been hearing about for a couple of years, now has added a tremendously unstable political landscape where the government seems more and more illegitimate, both domestically and abroad, losing allies left and right, and also facing significant dissent from within. Meanwhile, you have an opposition that seems to be splintering along a far more radical line than the mainstream it has been before. And that portends a situation that is not just explosive, but perhaps even far more deadly than we've seen. And already it's been a deadly few months with over 100 people dead in protests in a variety of means. So it's as dire as it can be.
Well, my understanding is that Venezuela is kind of like the NRA's dream country. You know, I'm being sarcastic, of course, but there's an awful lot of firearms in that country. It has the highest, I think one of the highest murder rates in the world and crime rates. But is there a possibility that the opposition, as it gets more and more radicalized, since essentially a coup has taken place against them and against their representation, they're out in the cold. What's the likelihood of that in a country awash with arms? In other words, are these young kids that are blocking streets and you know, they're pretty brave. They're being killed and they're standing up to riot police and all kinds of weaponry and tanks, etc. So what's your sense in that regard,
Alan? Yeah. I mean, it's hard to say at this stage. Venezuela has had several periods of armed conflict in its history, not even so long ago. The last guerrilla bands were disbanded in the 1980s. On the other hand, as you mentioned, the sort of the epidemic of violence really explodes in the early 2000s and mid-2000s, in part because of the tremendously easy availability of weapons, which also had to do with just the country being awash in cash, and the generally bad state of the rule of law in the country, even before the current crisis. However, I think that the likelihood of an immediate or at least a short-term turn towards armed struggle on the part of the opposition is limited, and that I think has to do for a couple of reasons. Even though it's true that we've seen increasing examples of some of these, not just youth, but other sort of more shadowy sectors of the opposition, taking a more violent path over the last several weeks, or with, for instance, a roadside makeshift bomb that was exploded in Caracas on a passing National Guard truck, and certainly there's been firearms that have been shot at. The opposition is really in a moment where if it takes an armed path, it will lose significant amounts of international, especially, credibility that it has taken a long time for it to build. And so, for instance, you've seen now major spokespersons of the opposition distance themselves from some of these more radical sectors. In the recent attack on army barracks that just happened on Sunday, for instance, you saw several opposition leaders denounce the move, saying that they would not support a military takeover of that sort. And so, they're really threading a very difficult, very fine line here in terms of, if we move along in a more violent way, then we're going to lose significant amount of standing. But not doing so, obviously, means that the road towards changing the government and taking power will be longer, perhaps even bloodier for us. So that's, that's the likelihood. I think it's small, but certainly latent.
And again, I'm speaking with Alejandro Velasco, who's a historian of modern Latin America at New York University, where he focuses on social movements, urban culture, and democratization. He's the author of Barrio Rising, Urban Popular Politics, and the Making of Modern Venezuela. So what's the situation then vis-a-vis the military following this, I don't know what you could call it, a sort of attempted coup, although the captain involved, he says that it wasn't a coup. He went out of his way to suggest that it wasn't a military coup, but an attempt to restore democracy. But nevertheless, traditionally, he said this is a civic and military action to reestablish the constitutional order. Well, it didn't go very far. And so what is the state of the military in terms of political control? Because I've talked to analysts down in Caracas who say that the Cubans are playing a very, very prominent role in SEBIN, the intelligence service, and in military intelligence, and that they have a disproportionate role in the direction that this government is taking. So is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I mean, certainly Cuba has had a long standing presence now for several years within the Venezuelan intelligence apparatus and also within the military more broadly. I think that the reasons keeping the military in line, I think, have less to do with the Cuban and the Cuban presence and more to do with the tremendous amount of investment that especially upper echelons of the military have made in terms of aligning with the government, either through nefarious deals in the context of drug dealing or other forms of corruption, or just the way that they have really marginalized themselves in an eventual transition government. They would have very little legs to stand on. So they've basically thrown in their lot with Maduro at this point, such that, especially again at the upper echelons of the military, it seems like his support is quite stable. The uncertainty comes precisely in those middle level ranks, captains, lieutenants, comandantes, so-called comacates in Venezuela, because those are the people that see sort of the corruption going on at the upper levels, and they're being asked to participate more and more, and that of course jeopardizes their eventual standing in any kind of transitional scenario. So it's really a moment for these middle ranks to take a stand, and this is exactly what some sections of the opposition are calling calling for. The challenge there, though, is that precisely because right now, they're, especially again at the upper echelons, there's very little movement going on in the military. These gestures, and that's really what these are. They're not coup attempts. They're not they're not even, they're barely insurrections. They're just gestures. What they're trying to do is to spark something, to create a spark that then catches on. And then not only will it allow other sectors of the military to say, well, if that one, if that regiment or if that other regiment is potentially rising up, then that allows us to do so. So they're, what they're doing is sort of testing and testing at the edges, testing at the margins of who is, especially these middle sectors of the military, who continues to be in support and whether they're going to continue to do so as the crisis worsens. So that's, it seems to be where the scenario stands right now. The military is solidly in support of Maduro, especially at the upper ranks, but it's in these middle ranks where we're seeing some movement.
But in terms of what motivated these soldiers to take this stance, and this captain in particular who led them, isn't it likely to get worse? If he's saying that he's trying to reestablish constitutional order, well, it looks like Maduro is determined to move further and further in the direction of establishing a kind of Cuban-style government, because he's going after the Attorney General and he arrested two opposition people, and they just seem to basically have contempt for the opposition, and they're just going to tough it out. Do you see any signs of reconciliation?
No, not at all. Not so long as both sides continue to have greater to lose by losing power than to lose by moving towards a transition, or in the case of the opposition, by negotiating than to try to negotiate a transition. And meanwhile, there's very few players internationally who have the ear of both the opposition and the government who could mediate in such an effort. So, the landscape for any kind of reconciliation seems to be quite reduced. But in terms of the military, Venezuela has experienced coups. I mean, certainly the last one that happened was 2002, when Chavez was briefly overthrown. And at that time, too, the military who participated in the coup said that this is not a coup. So the idea that, a captain saying this is not a coup means that it's not a coup, it's primarily rhetoric play. It's word play. The real issue is, as I was mentioning before, what this suggests is a splintering within the ranks of an institution that had remained the strongest vestige of support for the Maduro government. And if there is increasing, even very marginal indications that more and more players within the military are breaking ranks, then that might lead to a tipping point where you have, especially as you mentioned, as conditions continue to deteriorate and Maduro and the government show no signs of any kind of aperture towards the opposition or towards negotiating a transition, that would change the dynamic significantly. But for now, Maduro is making the bet that those sectors are quite reduced in number, that he and the military remain very much tied at the hip, and that they, and by virtue of controlling the guns, have a tremendous upper hand over an opposition that, if it were to try to move in the direction of armed struggle, not only would be quite easily militarily defeated, but more significantly would lose significant amounts of international credibility. So what we see is a stalemate, and that stalemate shows very few signs of ebbing.
Well, it's pretty clear that the South American and Central American governments are weighing in. I mean, obviously, Cuba and some of the Caribbean states that get subsidized oil, free oil from Venezuela, have supported the Maduro position. But he's pretty well isolated internationally, and except for Russia. As far as I know, Russia, Cuba, I'm not sure where else he's getting any support.
Perhaps China is a big source of support, continuing.
China. Well, China's, aren't they indebted?
Yeah, $55 billion in debt, for sure.
Right. So they may well be wondering whether that money's going to get repaid. But what's your sense then of what pressure that can be brought to bear from neighboring countries?
Yeah, the thing thing with the international landscape, at least regionally speaking, in terms of the hemisphere, that's confusing or at least difficult to parse is that, yes, for sure, there have been more and increasingly loud voices of opposition and condemnation of the Maduro government, which absolutely suggests an isolation of the country. But this, of course, is also happening at a time when, you know, the region is shifting rightward after what had been, you know, a decade plus of left-wing governance. And so, to some extent, this is neither unexpected and also not even unwelcome on the part of the Maduro government. You know, the fact that countries like Brazil, which had, of course, its own highly questionable and controversial switch of government from Dilma Rousseff to Michel Temer a couple of years ago. Countries like Argentina, countries like Peru that have had, you know, swings to the right, that in Mexico that has never had a friendly relationship with Venezuela in the Chavez era. The fact that it's these countries that are taking the lead in condemning Venezuela plays to some extent into the hands of Maduro, who can say, look, it's the right, the international right that is attacking Venezuela. And certainly when Trump and the United States government throws in and suggests a very robust set of sanctions that perhaps even include, as Senator Marco Rubio has suggested, seizing, stopping purchasing of Venezuelan oil, which would, of course, be catastrophic for Venezuela. You know, that, again, also plays into the hands of Maduro. And rather than creating an incentive for negotiation, it actually does the opposite. It creates, you know, the incentive for retrenchment. So in terms of the regional landscape of increasing isolation, sort of paradoxically, it plays into Maduro's hands rather than the opposite. You know, the only area where one can see some movement is in the Vatican, which does have a significant degree of credibility from the opposition as well as the government. But, you know, the Vatican and the Pope have made some really strong statements over the last few days, condemning, for instance, the vote of the Constituent Assembly as fraudulent, condemning the whole process as rigged. And so it seems that the landscape for a potential negotiation, at least for now, continues to be quite reduced.
Well, in terms of support for Maduro and for his predecessor, Chavez, amongst European socialist countries and parties, for example, the British opposition leader, Jeremy Corbyn, was put on the spot by the press. And basically, they, you know, they wanted to find out how he feels about his previous praise for Maduro and particularly for Chavez. And Corbyn, you know, gave a pretty mealy-mouthed kind of answer, saying that I give support of many people around the world for the principles of a government that was dedicated towards reducing inequality and improving the lives of its poorest people, which certainly was the case. You know, that's something that unquestionably happened under Chavez in terms of taking care of the most marginalized people in that country. But he also sort of said he's very much against, it's very sad, the people who have died, either those in the streets or security forces that have been attacked by the people on the streets, all of their lives are terrible for the loss of them. So this seems to be at least making some of the apologists in Europe on the left a little uncomfortable. I mean, I find it extraordinary that people can't see that an oil-rich country that is on the verge of collapse, that there's something wrong there, that Maduro and Chavez are, if this is socialism, they're giving socialism a bad name, surely.
Yeah, it's a moment of reckoning for the international left, especially the left that placed a tremendous amount of hope and aspiration on Chavez. I think mostly, I think Maduro is to some extent a slightly separate question, although, you know, certainly there are continuities that one can and should keep in mind. You know, but I think that dreams die hard, and one of the things that Chavez really, you know, proposed and to some extent executed well was at a time, not only in Latin America, but in the world when, you know, especially in the 1990s, there seemed to be a sense that the world was moving full speed ahead towards a, you know, highly kind of neoliberal form of global rule in terms of economies and politics, that there was an alternative that was, as you mentioned, that held in higher standing a concern for popular sectors, for social classes left out of, in the case of Venezuela, the oil pipe, but more broadly speaking, sort of the benefits of globalization, right? So, you know, he held that that place, and of course banged that drum significantly, not just in Latin America but throughout the world, and so to the extent that, you know, much of what was accomplished in the Chavez era in terms of advances in social gains, reductions in poverty, food security, access to health, et cetera, et cetera, many of those gains have now been reverted and to some extent, you know, retreated. It's a difficult moment to sort of say, well, you know, what went wrong? And I think what gives people pause on the international left is the extent to which, even though, you know, Chavismo and Maduro in particular, because of many of the economic choices, especially that they've made, have brought Venezuela to this point, you know, the opposition is not blameless in terms of both in the early period of the Chavez era staging sort of openly, disloyal forms of some forms of engagement, but also, you know, international forms of capital pressure that are exerted upon countries that try to break from a neoliberal mold. And so it's not quite as clear cut, I think, especially for the international left to say, well, you know, Venezuela is an unmitigated disaster, and therefore we should, you know, throw our lot with the opposition. The fact that there are very unsavory alternatives in Venezuela, I think, is what gives people like Corbyn this opportunity to, you know, to say, yes, we reject what's happening, but at the same time, that doesn't mean that we will, you know, support whatever alternative comes next, right? And again, when you lace that with this, difficult surrendering of what was that moment in time in the early 2000s when Chavez was really the only person saying there is an alternative, there is another way to neoliberalism. That's I think what leads to a lot of this, a lot of this skepticism that doesn't quite resolve to fully and full-throatedly condemn Maduro.
Well, Alejandro Velasco, I thank you very much for joining us, and I appreciate your time.
Oh, I thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Alejandro Velasco, who is an historian of modern Latin America at New York University, where he focuses on social movements, urban culture, and democratization. He's the author of Barrio Rising, Urban Popular Politics, and the Making of Modern Venezuela. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing the possibility of imaginative diplomacy ending the stalemate between the United States and North Korea. Porque está viejo y cansado, pero no se dan de cuenta que un corazón amarrado, cuando le sueltan las riendas es caballo desbocado. Y si una potra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra, el pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a falseta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran falsas riendas. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Kyung Moon Hwang, who is a professor of history at the University of Southern California. He's the author of A History of Korea, now in its second edition, and his latest book is Rationalizing Korea, The Rise of the Modern State. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kyung Moon Hwang.
Thank you.
And obviously, the North Korean representative at the ASEAN conference in Manila, which North Korea doesn't normally get invited to, was pretty upset about these sanctions that the UN Security Council have voted on unanimously. And that in itself is pretty unusual, isn't it, for both China and Russia to weigh in. And from what I understand, the sanctions will deny, at least this is the reports we get, is it'll deny North Korea about $1 billion in revenues from exports. And that's one third of their foreign exchange. At least that's what the reports say. It's hard to believe that a country could operate only on $3 billion. But let's start with that. Are those accurate figures? And are they being punished to the tune of one third of their export income?
I don't know where those figures come from. I've read the same figures as you have just outlined. It's, of course, notoriously difficult to get accurate figures, whether it's economic or otherwise, from North Korea. I imagine that a lot of this comes from within Chinese sources, and that would make it fairly accurate if indeed that's the case, because it's the Chinese are by far the biggest trade partner with North Korea.
So cutting off exports of coal, seafood, lead and iron, that seems to be what they're talking about. What's left? I mean, what? And also, I understand that both China and in particular Russia, which has been using a lot of North Korean labor in its Pacific provinces for construction work, where apparently they work really hard, long hours, and whatever the pay they get goes to the North Korean government. Russia's agreed to also cut off the flow of cheap labor.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly how that's going to work. You know, does human labor count as an export from North Korea? Because that's what the Russians are depending on. That's what they exploit. So to what extent the Russian participation in these sanctions will have a major impact, I'm not really sure. It seems they would not be that large. Again, by far the biggest trading partner for North Korea is China. So one would think that, as you suggested, there aren't that many items currently that the North Koreans export to China. The coal is lifted, but it's difficult to imagine that the North Koreans could afford to export coal. And the Chinese, of course, have a lot of coal in their own. They produce a lot of coal there. So I'm not sure how accurate that report is. But you're right. It's difficult to fathom what other things the North Koreans might be exporting that is of great value to the Chinese. I'm thinking, you know, traditionally, people in Northern Korea cultivated ginseng and other medicinals that were highly prized in China, and to a certain extent that's been continuing. And I'm not sure if that's a major component of the trade right now. But
so obviously, though, China could do more. In other words, for example, they could cut off their exports of fuel, which North Korea is entirely dependent upon. But the Chinese don't want a collapse of that regime, do they? They don't want, I think my understanding is, one, they don't want to have a flood of refugees. And two, they've looked at the German reunification and they're kind of worried about the idea that a united Korea could be an economic juggernaut. And third, they don't want the United States military on their border.
Yeah, I think that third one is really the most important consideration from the Chinese perspective, from what they have signaled in the past. It's a security issue by far. And I think even more than having the prospect of a unified, non-Chinese-oriented Korea is the prospect of having a pro-American unified Korea on Chinese borders. So it's a typical perspective of a traditional kind of imperialist power. It's the same as Russian behavior these days. As far as the concerns over the flooding of refugees, of course, that always is a major concern. But I would think the South Koreans behind the scenes could allay those fears. And I think the South Koreans could allay some of the fears concerning the orientation of the unified Korea as well. I think that leaves us really with the prospect of an American presence right on its borders being really the most important consideration for the Chinese in not wanting to see reunification take place. But is that enough for the Chinese to continue to hold the hands of the North Korean regime that is doing things that obviously are going against the wishes of the Chinese? regime itself. That's really the big question. I think here the diplomacy that the South Koreans have been undertaking for the past, 25 years to try to overcome Chinese resistance to reunification or resistance to closer connections with South Korea have been doing. And so we'll see how far that diplomacy continues to have an effect. It's really quite striking, though, that this UN Security Council resolution did gain the consent, or at least did not get blocked by the veto of the Chinese or the Russians.
And again, I'm speaking with Kyung-moon Hwang, who is a professor of history at the University of Southern California. He's the author of A History of Korea, now in its second edition, and his latest book is Rationalizing Korea, The Rise of the Modern State. But in terms of the North Korean Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho's remarks at the ASEAN Regional Forum, it's pretty clear, and he's certainly making it clear, that under no circumstances would North Korea negotiate away its nuclear weapons. And he went on to say that since the emergence of nuclear weapons in the world, it has been proved throughout history that nukes can deter war. So is that what's going on here? That's the assumption a lot of people make, like Bruce Cummings and other analysts of North Korea, that the North Koreans learned from what happened with Saddam Hussein, where the U.S. invaded and toppled him based upon the false claim that he had nuclear weapons. And had he had them, he might have been able to deter the invasion. So is that the lesson learned?
Well, yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. The other aspect of that, though, that is just as important to keep in mind is that this regime, just like most other dictatorships, are driven first and foremost by regime preservation as the primary goal. And so the regime preservation has a military component in which you're proof of having nuclear weaponry will definitely do an effective job of preventing some kind of military strike on the part of an outside force. And so that's what they're trying to do. And they make no bones about it, as you say. The other, though, aspect is that this is very important for the regime to preserve its domination within the country. And so the internal component of this propaganda is just as important. And the United States has always been, since the Korean War, a major bogeyman for the Northern regime to prop itself up, to strengthen its legitimacy and to sustain its legitimacy after the death of the founder himself. And the founder himself was, of course, very eager to fabricate his own history in relation to the United States, saying that the North Koreans not only beat back an American invasion in the Korean War, but that Kim Il-sung himself, the founder, was the one who made that possible. And so the regime's legitimacy has been based on these extraordinarily bitter and horrific memories of American bombing in the Korean War. And so the Americans will continue to have this very important utilitarian value for internal propaganda in order to sustain the regime. And I think that's really important to keep in mind.
Well, I've asked a number of experts on Korea the question of whether, as you recall, Gorbachev, before the end of the Cold War, made the announcement that we will no longer be the USA's enemy. In other words, you're not going to have a Cold War enemy anymore. And he did that with some sort of irony. So I've suggested that what would happen if the US suddenly plonked a peace treaty on the table at Panmunjom and said, let's end the Korean War. It's an armistice, it's not a treaty, and we don't want to be your enemy anymore. Now, I know it's incredibly naive, but that would take away the glue that holds that regime together. So I suppose to that extent, it's never going to happen. But what's your thoughts on that matter?
Well, I think it will happen. It would happen if indeed that was done. I think putting forth a peace treaty on the table with North Korea would go a long way toward not only solving the immediate problem, or at least helping to solve the immediate problem of nuclear proliferation on the part of North Korea. And the North Koreans, I think, will never really give up their nuclear weapons, but they can be coaxed, perhaps, into stopping its growth or stopping further development. But in the long run, I think that's exactly what can be done with such a stand down from the hostility, and that is to, hopefully anyway, make gains toward conducing and opening up of the country. And that has been proven throughout history over the past, half a century, or at least past 30 or so years. That is going to be the most important effective way of changing North Korea. I think that would really is ultimately the only way to bring about some kind of resolution to this continuing crisis that we seem to have with North Korea. You know, it is a terrible regime, but you do have to, I think, find some kind of longer-term strategy to make things better for the regional and national community in that security sense, but also to make things better for the suffering North Korean population. And I think given that, it might not be a bad idea to do something striking like that, and that is to say, hey, you know, we Americans do not want to be your enemy. We want to pursue some kind of formal peace treaty. As long as the South Koreans are involved in this, I think it can work and it can be effective.
Well, Secretary of State Tillerson didn't go that far, of course, but he did say that the U.S. is not interested in regime change, which was a clear, you know, olive branch, because most of the rhetoric, and he, I don't think he got the entire support of the Trump administration behind him, by the way. We don't exactly know. It's hard to know what's going on with that crowd. They, you know, one day it's tweeting one thing and the next another. So it's almost impossible to follow foreign policy in the Trump administration. But what would prevent the U.S. or and or the South Koreans from taking an imaginative step like that, to plonk a peace treaty on the table and say, okay, we don't want to be your enemy anymore?
That's a good question. The thing that comes to mind immediately to me is Donald Trump. You know, it's tough. It's difficult to get him to think about anything in depth and to, you know, numb his itchy fingers, whether it's for tweeting or for anything else more dangerous. And I should say here that from my perspective as a longtime Korea watcher, the most disruptive thing that has happened over the past half a year concerning North Korea has been Donald Trump. Nothing really has changed that much, even with the constant missile tests and all that. We knew that the nuclear program has been developing for 20 years. Nothing really has changed that fundamentally except for the insertion of this wild card, and that was the Trump administration. So I'm not really sure whether, you know, something sensible can result from the current American government, but you never know. So, I mean, you know, I'm glad I'm not in the prediction game, because I think it'd be difficult to do so with the administration.
Well, it's pretty clear, though, from North Korea's response to the sort of chance meeting at this dinner at the ASEAN conference on Sunday night, where the North Korean Foreign Minister Ri sort of ran into his South Korean counterpart, and they had a brief chat, but then Ri then quickly rebuffed any idea of negotiations, saying that the offer that was made was insincere. That tells me that, isn't that a part of the game? The North Koreans don't want to talk to the South because they figure you're a puppet state. We have to talk to the puppet master, the Americans.
Yeah, that's at least the formal stance anyway. It's always been the formal stance. Although, of course, the North Koreans have talked directly with the South Koreans frequently over the past few decades. And so I think there's some kind of instability, if you want to call it that, or discombobulation taking place in the Northern regime in response to this UN Security Council resolution. And so it's difficult to fathom any kind of large consistency aside from the typical bombast, as we have seen. Although they did have a formal state or government declaration in response to that resolution. So that's not that usual. So that was interesting. I think that's really more of a sign as to how the North Koreans are trying to figure out what exactly to do in response to this, with Russia and China now on board in the sanctions.
Well, are the North Koreans lucky to get aboard the Moscow and Beijing, the Chinese and the Russian plan for what they call a freeze for a freeze, where North Korea freezes its missile and nuclear testing while the U.S. and its allies stop conducting joint military exercises?
Yeah, I think, it's difficult for me to be sure about this kind of thing, of course, but I would gather that the northern regime would be open to that kind of negotiation. And you have to understand that there's a lot of historical support for the North fears of the United States based on the Korean War and based on what happened thereafter as well, but especially based on the Korean War. And you would think that if the northern regime can be assured of keeping its current stockpile, even if they can't develop it any further, and bring about what they have always seen as the worst and most provocative event, and that is the annual military exercises with South Korea and the United States, which, again, they have a legitimate gripe about, which they have a legitimate fear of. And I think that has, that retains a strong possibility of gaining acceptance by the northern regime.
Well, Kyung Moon Hwang, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Kyung Moon Hwang, who is a professor of history at the University of Southern California. He's the author of A History of Korea Now in its Second Edition, and his latest book is Rationalizing Korea, The Rise of the Modern State. We can take a brief station break and be back investigating the real reasons behind the opioid crisis in America and why the epidemic is not being dealt with effectively. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Stephen Schwartz, the editor of the daily web publication, theschwartzreport.net, which concentrates on trends that will shape the future. Previously, he was the senior Samueli Fellow in Brain, Mind, and Healing at the Samueli Institute, and his latest book is The Eight Laws of Change, and he has an article in the journal Explore, America's Deadly Opioid Epidemic, from which everyone but the users profits. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Schwartz.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you, Ian.
Thank you, Stephen. And yesterday I did a piece on West Virginia trying to figure out what's going on, why Trump keeps going there all the time, and trying to answer the paradox that West Virginia has the worst opioid crisis and the highest death rate from opioids, yet the hero, Donald Trump, is going to cut Medicaid funding, which is the main source of treatment for opioid addiction. But nevertheless, I'm glad that you're joining us here today to do a kind of follow-up on the epidemic itself. Now, one of the things about the war on drugs is that the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, has always said we go after the source. For example, they sprayed tons and tons of herbicides on the jungles of Colombia to try and eradicate the coca crop. Because, and these were quite often hidden drug labs in the jungles. Well, the drug labs in the opioid crisis are extremely identifiable. They're big pharma. They're Purdue and all of these big pharmaceutical companies. It's not like they're hidden. They're in plain sight. So why isn't the Drug Enforcement Administration, going after the source of the opioid crisis?
Because the pharmaceutical corporations are spending millions of dollars buying the Congress, of course, and the executive branch. I'd say it is the most astonishing story, I think, really, of the last several decades. We now have, but in 2015, we had 20.5 million Americans aged 12 or older who had substance abuse disorder. That's about 6% of the population. You know, we're about 320 million people. So to give you some scale of that, that's a number bigger than all the Mormons, all the Orthodox Christians, all the Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, and Hindus in the United States collectively. And it was all done absolutely legally. we created this. We now have, as I say, over 20 and a half million people. 2 million were involved with prescription pain relievers. 591,000 were involved with heroin, because there's a linkage between these opioids and heroin. When people can't get the opioids, they go to heroin because it's so cheap. But this entire crisis of opioids and the death rate that it has now created was done entirely legally. In fact, if you think about it, the three biggest killers in the United States, guns, automobile accidents, and opioids, are all perfectly legal. We watched it happen. It all began back in the early 70s with the synthetic opioids, that Percocet and Vicodin, which weren't supposed to be addictive, but of course were, and were supposed to replace morphine, but it really took off in 96 when Purdue Pharma brought out OxyContin onto the market. And in the early 90s, U.S. pharmacies typically filled 2 or 3 million prescriptions for pain medications in a year. In a single year, from 95 to 96, it increased by 8 million. Well, we created this thing. It's a completely legal drug addiction, and it's financed, and it is unregulated in the sense that you ask, because the corporations that do it are spending enormous sums of money to make sure that the Congress and the regulatory agencies don't do anything about it.
And in 2007, when Purdue Pharma introduced OxyContin, they, in their literature, which they sent out to doctors, they said that this was not addictive, right?
Yes, that's right. All of these things are from one to the other. I mean, it all traces back originally to opium and then to morphine, and all of them, I mean, heroin. Heroin is called heroin because it was supposed to be a heroic drug that would help people not get addicted to opium and morphine. So, I mean, and you were mentioning West Virginia. I don't know whether you got into this, but this is one of the things. I started covering this in 2008 because you could see it happening. I mean, anybody with a brain could watch the process. It's just astonishing. In one little West Virginia town of 392 people, they sent out 7 million OxyContin pills out of one tiny pharmacy in one tiny little town of 392 people. I mean, and nobody noticed? No, of course everybody noticed. The middlemen, we don't think about, not only the pharma manufacturers, but the middlemen distributors, the drugstores themselves, the doctors that prescribed, everybody was in on it, but it was making millions of dollars for them, and so it just kept on going and growing until in areas like West Virginia, because people take these drugs out of desperation and poverty and a sense of hopelessness, the entire state was just overtaken by this. And yes, you're right, that, of course, the Trump administration is talking about now cutting back and medical coverage, but it's like everything else they're doing. I'm sure you noticed that we're just seeing, starting yesterday, articles about the TTP trade policy, in which it's becoming clear that we are losing ground because of the Trump policies. The recent statement he made about supporting petroleum energy, that's what America's commitment is going to cost us trillions of dollars, millions of jobs. The Chinese have figured out that they're going to be the dominant people in terms of solar and wind energy, and are making enormous sums of money, and will make more and more as everybody converts. Because as you can see in Europe, already they're committing that by 2040, 2045, France, England, Finland, Norway, Holland, they're all talking about being 100% electric vehicle on their roads, and at the same time that we're trying to get the coal industry started. So
right.
it's
Well, you know, there's a possibility that Donald Trump has been on Putin's payroll, but maybe he's also been on on Xi Jinping's payroll as well. Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Schwartz, the editor of the daily web publication, theschwartzreport.net, which concentrates on trends that will shape the future. Previously, he was a senior Samueli Fellow in Brain, Mind, and Healing at the Samueli Institute, and his latest book is The Eight Laws of Change, and he has an article in the journal Explore, America's Deadly Opioid Epidemic, from which everyone but the users profits. So there's so much coverage of the opioid addiction. Of course, we have an attorney general who's obsessed with marijuana, and he's completely blind to the opioid crisis. And of course, if they employ the war on drug tactics, they'll just beat up the users. As I said in the opening, it's not as if, you know, when they say they go after the source and go after the drug kingpins. Well, the drug kingpins in this case are in the boardrooms of Purdue Pharma.
And major donors to the Republican Party. Absolutely.
Well, and I'm sure to the Democrats, too. I mean, they bought Congress.
Yes, everybody. Of course.
So is it possible, then, that one of the reasons why, because your piece in Explore is the first time anybody's actually, that I can see in print and in the media, has pointed out the obvious, that this is, you know, drug pushing by Big Pharma, and it could be stopped if you stopped Big Pharma pushing this drug on all of these people who get addicted to it. You know, what's the difference between them and some heroin pusher? And one of the
cleaner suits.
Have you noticed that network TV now all the advertising is dominated by Big Pharma? Without Big Pharma, ABC, CBS, and NBC and Fox would have gone bankrupt by now. Is that why they're not covering this story in the way that that your article points out, that they're making the obvious linkage between the opioid epidemic and the manufacturers of these drugs like Purdue?
I think that actually, Ian, is a very interesting question. I'm not in the boardrooms of those networks, so I can't answer it in any definitive way, but I think you are correct in observing that there is a strange silence about this and who created it and the actual impact that it's making. I mean, you do see coverage. We don't want to over-exaggerate. You do see coverage, but we are not seeing the kind of public discourse, not only about this addiction epidemic, but also why are these people getting addicted to these drugs? This isn't coming out of the blue. This is arising in states like West Virginia or Kentucky or Texas because there is poverty, there is loss of hope. It's the same, it's another aspect, another facet of the same trend that has created the Trump base. I mean, if these are people who are in a fear fugue, who see the world changing in ways they don't understand, they see loss of position for themselves, loss of a future, loss of affluence, and they turn to drugs because they are in a fear fugue and are desperate and unhappy. And we're not talking about that at all. Why is it that uniquely amongst the nations of the developed world, we don't have universal health care? It's not because of money, although that's the way it always gets discussed. The truth is that we spend more on health care than any other country in the world. So it's not that we're getting good results. We have the 37th worst health care system in the world. It's that we spend preposterous sums of money for health care because we don't have a healthcare system. We have an illness profit system. The function of the whole thing is to produce profit. And when profit is a higher priority than wellness, this is what you get. And the fact that we won't talk about it, that we won't think about it in those terms, I think is one of the alarm bells that we should be looking at, telling us that our society has gone significantly off the rails. And it's not a political issue. It's about what is the function of society. Is the function of society well-being, or is the function of society to create conditions for mass, the largest profit? And I don't. Until we answer that question, we're not going to solve the drug problem or any of the other problems.
Well, it's you know, we're talking about profit over human lives in this opioid.
Yes, absolutely.
Opioid epidemic, and it sort of has echoes of Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, where everybody's hooked on soma to placate them. Now, in this case, the people who become addicted, who have the existential pain that you're talking about in terms of their being downsized, outsourced, and feeling left behind. Of course, they have the cover of not going into a back alley to get their drugs, but they go to the pharmacy, and it's all above board. So
yes, it's all legal. It's all perfectly tidy.
So
you go to a doctor, he writes a prescription. You go to the drugstore at the corner, and they fill the prescription. It's all perfectly legal. It's all perfectly clean. You're not having to hang out in nasty alleyways with questionable people. No, the whole thing is the appearance of normality, that this is happening within the healthcare system, is a function of how disordered the healthcare system has become, or how it has become an illness profit system.
Well, in the last minute, what do you think, apart from your article in Explore and this interview that we're doing on public radio here at KPFK in Los Angeles, what's going to... That's not going to change the world as much as I'd like to think it would. What do you think can be done to get this word out that let's go after these drug dealers, Big Pharma?
Well, yes. I mean, I think what we need is a national conversation, which we're not having, about what do we mean when we say healthcare? You know, we're not at all clear about that. You can see from the recent debates that went on in the Congress that people have radically different ideas about this. I would suggest to you that what we need to do is to say that the function of the healthcare system is to foster well-being. Now, how do we do that? Because you can't solve the drug problem as an isolated thing, as if it had no other reference to any other part of the social structure. That isn't going to do it. You know, it's not like we're going to send everybody to AA or something. That's not how you solve these problems. We have systemic social issues which we are not addressing. We do not make well-being of the individual, the family, the community, the nation our first priority. We make profit our first priority. That's the problem.
Nice.
Not that I'm against profit. You can make all the profits you want, and in fact, people like the Chinese are doing that, producing well-being by creating alternative energy, for instance.
Okay.
Well, but you just can't make it your first priority.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time here today, but I thank you very much for joining us, Stephen Schwartz.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Schwartz, who's the editor of the daily web publication, theschwartzreport.net, which concentrates on trends that will shape the future. Previously, he was a senior Samueli Fellow in Brain, Mind, and Healing at the Samueli Institute, and his latest book is The Eight Laws of Change, and he has an article in the journal Explore, America's Deadly Opioid Epidemic, from which everyone but the users profits. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time will find in America.